You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
This is Columbia Calling, and I'm Richard McCall, here for the new show today, Columbia Calling. And we'll be speaking to Marie Quinney later on in the show. She's down in Cali, so we'll be connecting with her to talk about her life in the development sector down there, how a young Anglo-French lady ended up in Cali. And she will reveal all, of course. It will be a great chat with Marie Quinney. And, of course, her blog is Honestly Cali. Just put that into Google, Honestly Cali, C-A-L-I, and you'll find out all about her. Well, yes, it's been another long weeks in politics, long weeks in journalism. It's been a bit of a slow week, but in truth, things are happening. Just, of course, identified by the fact that a landslide on Sunday in Putumayo has left what people are saying is the image of Jesus Christ into a wall, you know, where the landslide has slipped away, leaving the jungle bare. They've started to see Jesus Christ, his effigy there in the dirt. And like all good capitalists, people who own the land nearby to this thing in Putumayo are charging between 1,000 and 2,000 pesos to permit people access to observe this, miracle. Anyway, yeah, that's that. But I really want to talk about in these first couple of minutes that I had the best experience last week. I managed to meet a close friend of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. It's called Carlos Alemán Zabaleta. It turned out that he lives in the building alongside mine. Born in Mompós in 1915. So the gentleman is 95 years old, going to turn on 96. Lucid, erudite, well-read, and could tell me all sorts of anecdotes about Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And in fact, this Carlos Alemán Zabaleta, being the courteous host that he was, gifted me his book with a great, you know, little entitlement inside. But he was telling me about how he was the one who looked after Garcia Marquez in Cartagena and in Barranquilla in those penniless days up there on the coast while he was making 35 pesos, yes, 35 pesos for an article at the Universal in Cartagena, and then when he moved to Barranquilla to work, he got about 90 pesos, which then as now more or less comes to nothing. So journalism hasn't changed, folks. It's not going anywhere. These things don't pay. But as you know, things do get better. But so interesting to talk to this man and read some of his book. I've started reading the first couple of chapters. And of course, he's talking about it back in the 1915, 1920s and so on before he left to study elsewhere. He talks about an attempt on his life when he was a politician in Cartagena, where the bullet grazes his arm. He talks about his relationship with Gabriel Garcia Marquez. There's a photo of him in 1944 with Jorge Elisier Gaitán in Mompós when Gaitán was the minister for work. So fascinating guy. He told me about his time in Bogotá during the Bogotazo. That's the 9th of April back in 1948, so a date almost upon us again, an anniversary. But he said he went and took, he sought asylum in the Venezuelan embassy that day because reprisals were going on. And as he was a student agitator from the National University, a student of law, he was being looked for by the conservative forces. So he went and sought asylum in the Venezuelan embassies. But fantastic stories to hear from. And so I will write about this at some point. I will write about this as we get closer and closer to the launch of Was Gabo an Irishman, the new anthology that Caroline Doherty de Novoa, Victoria Kellaway and I edited and contributed to, but with 26 essays about Colombia and Macondian Colombia. As soon as we get closer to that, I will write about my meeting with Carlos Alemán Zabaleta. My most recent blog on my website, richardmccall.com, has been, of course, just a little observation of the different social strata in the city. Only brought about by turning the wrong corner the other day when as I was driving downtown, and you can see it. It was called one wrong block or something like that. Anyway, I saw signs in the windows offering bunk beds for 5,000 pesos. The DOS houses where, salesmen just selling the chicles, the gum in the street, end up at night if they've made enough money. I saw places like that and so on. And, we know these places exist, but they're so out of view to so many of us, and especially if you're just traveling here. If you're living here, then you get a bit more of an idea. But fascinating times in Colombia, as always. Don't go away, because we're going to take a short break and we'll be back with Marie Quinney talking about her life in Cali. So we'll get to hear tropical birds in the background, and we can imagine ourselves in the wonderful, verdant and vibrant life of Cali, the southern economic and industrial hub of Colombia. This is Colombia Calling, and I'm Richard McCall. Please stay tuned. Thank you.
And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall here in Bogota, and it's my very great pleasure to introduce a new interviewee to the show, a listener, but she's down there in the city of Cali, the southern, industrial and economic hub of Colombia. Her name is Marie Quinney. She's half French, half English, and she's basically set up a life for herself down there in Cali. So welcome on the show, Marie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Now, you are the second person from, you're based in Cali that we've had on the show, so you are quite a novelty.
Oh,
tell us a little bit. Now, obviously, you've got this blog that's Honestly Cali, so you can look that up there. You are, you're a development environmental specialist. You're based down there in Cali. But how did it come to be that you, decided to make your life, for the time being at least, in Cali?
Well, I've got a bit of a long and complicated relationship with Colombia. About 4 years ago in 2011, I came here as part of my undergraduate degree with the British Council, as so many people do in Colombia, to teach English. So I was put in Cali in a university, and unfortunately I didn't have a great experience due to quite a difficult boss. Let's just put it that way, put it kindly. So that wasn't great, and because of the long working hours and things, I didn't actually get to explore that much of the culture. But one good thing that happened is I met my boyfriend, who I'm still with. And so I always wanted to come back and kind of have that experience that I was kind of denied. And then after I finished my undergraduate, I went on to do a master's in environment and development. And I ended up doing my dissertation about Cali. So I always kind of maintained this link and this interest with Cali. That's where it kind of came from.
So, but I mean, essentially over the last 4 years, then you've been sort of, sourcing a life in Cali. So you were here for the university, you had your love-hate relationship quite clearly. I think most of us go through that. I think everyone can associate with that situation. Yeah. So you were in the British Council. So I did that in Guatemala, but that was a few years ago now. and then of course you're back. You did this MSc in Environment Development at the London School of Economics, and I mean that's a serious degree, so you wanted to bring it out here to Cali. And what I find really fascinating though is knowing that you did it, your thesis, your dissertation, I guess, your thesis on what was it called? It's Fatalism and Poverty in Cali.
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds incredibly academic, but tell us about it, because I think it's fascinating. Fatalism. Are you delving into the sort of whole feeling of destiny that things are already written here in Colombia?
Yeah, there's definitely that side to fatalism. It's basically, within development in poverty, it's the theory that kind of the poorer you are, or the kind of more difficult your life is, the more likely you are to be fatalistic. That was kind of the hypothesis. And I found that really interesting because my time here 4 years ago, I'd kind of got from talking to different people and just observing life here, that I kind of got the feeling that everything, the state of affairs in terms of poverty and inequality were kind of just accepted. And I found that really difficult to get my head around. So I started exploring that. And then I came to the idea of fatalism, this theory. So I wanted to test it here. So I did lots of interviews with some kind of disadvantaged groups. And I was basically asking them why they thought their life was difficult. So what they attributed their poverty or their disability or whatever might be difficult in their life, whether they thought, for example, it was the government or the policy or history or something else. And actually, I found that the majority of my participants attributed their poverty or their difficult circumstances to God, which might not be very surprising to a lot of people who know Colombia or even Latin American cultures. But in terms of kind of development, it did have some difficult implications because, I mean, I don't know how much detail you want me to go into, but
go for it. It's fascinating.
Yeah? Right. So basically, I found that there were two types of fatalism. One, which I kind of called negative fatalism, which was that a lot of participants were just kind of resigned to their position in society and to their life of destitution. They were kind of like, oh, it's God's plan. You know, I have to live out this life that God gave me. And then on the other hand, there was another group which was slightly more positive in that their fatalism gave them a bit of hope. It was like, this is God's plan, but I know that God loves me and he's going to make my life better, you know. So there was, for example, there's one participant who would look through bins for food. And so his fatalism kind of expressed itself when he said, you know, I know that one day I'm going to look through these bins for food and I'm going to find a gold chain because God loves me. So it was kind of like giving them a hope that things are going to get better. So it was fascinating, but I mean, also obviously heartbreaking to hear people's stories, but it was such a unique experience. When you live here, you never really get into people's lives. You never really have these big conversations with people. So it was a great experience to see what goes on in these individuals' lives. So the reason why, well, I found it important to assess was because the implication for their lives is that actually, a lot of them said that they would refuse help, or, for example, if an NGO or the government came with a project to give them housing or food or education or training, that a lot of them actually believed that it wasn't going to change anything because it's always going to be bad, or that their lives are going to improve, but it's God that's going to do it. So nothing they can do could improve it. So they would kind of refuse help or refuse kind of making links with people or being active politically or whatever it might be. So that's obviously a challenge for development, that there might be opportunities out there, but they're not being taken advantage of because of this kind of psychological aspect that poverty brings on people. And I found that it was probably a coping mechanism, which is logical in terms of the fact that poverty is so difficult to deal with. You know, a life of difficulty, a life of destitution, it's a natural kind of response to that, that you want to kind of externalize the responsibility and the causes. You want to externalize it, and it's easier to cope with just saying, you know, oh, it's fine, it's in God's hands. So yeah, that's basically what I found in short.
It's absolutely, I mean, it's so almost thrilling to hear someone talking like this, to actually sort of, let's say, uncover it, because it's something, of course, I see on a daily basis. You know, right. Here and people always say, oh, you know, it wasn't meant to be. And I went, right. Well, you know, if you didn't get up, if you didn't get out of the house, and you didn't get to the interview on time, you know,
right.
All of these things are not the things that God, you know, for me, it's not God doing that. It's you didn't set your alarm, you know.
Yeah.
And so this struggle for sort of like fate and destiny is something that I grapple with,
yeah,
on a daily basis. So it's fascinating to see this. And I'm so thrilled that you have this blog out there that actually deals with, you know, real issues, as opposed to, like you said, you know, sugarcoating the life in Colombia. But of course, if you're an 18-year-old and you're sugarcoating life in Colombia, it's all different. But yours is very much getting beneath,
yeah,
the situation in Colombia. So, I mean, really, really interesting. And how did you choose the participants for your study?
Well, it was a bit of a tricky one because obviously you can differentiate the poor from non-poor just kind of physically, but it's a bit of a kind of blurred line. So obviously there's an element of that. Naturally, there's an element of, you know, if you see somebody rummaging through a bin, you can assume that they've got a difficult life. But also, officially, the way I kind of distinguished that was using the strata system, which, if anybody knows about Colombia, is the official kind of way, socioeconomic kind of scale that people are put into based on the neighborhood they live in. So there was a few people who I wanted to interview or I started kind of talking to, and when asking where they live to kind of get an idea of their lives, they actually were strata, you know, 4 or 5. So I was focusing on strata 1, 2, and 3, which are the lowest 3. That's how I kind of divided the poor from non-poor. But obviously it's very blurred. You could be living in strata 4 and still be having big difficulties. So you had to cut it off at some point.
And how was it received, this study back in the UK?
Well, very well. Yeah, my supervisor was very impressed. I mean, it was nothing. He didn't know anything about it. It wasn't his area of a specialty, and it's such an under-researched area. The whole psychology of poverty, especially fatalism, it's had really bad kind of press in academia in the 80s and 90s. So it's kind of been untouched. But I mean, I think the way that I addressed it and the way I justified it, kind of highlighted its importance. So so yeah, my department were really pleased. I did very well in it. So hopefully that's going to contribute to more of the literature and kind of be a reminder that, you know, these things are important. The little things count.
And can we read that anywhere? Is it online? Is it somewhere that we can find, or do we have to go to the library?
No, it's not online actually. I was thinking of where to publish it. I guess I could put a link to it on my blog. Because I've got a blog post in the works about poverty and related topics. So perhaps at the end of that, I'll put a link to my dissertation. That might be a good way to introduce it.
Well, certainly, because your readers are people who would want to read that because they know you. Well, fantastic to be speaking to you about this and about serious situations here in Colombia and of course Cali, because that's your epicenter, let's say. And I've seen blogs on your page about mentioning the sort of the Happy Planet Index, which you go into in quite some detail about, you know, so let's say the equations that create the chosen methodology of this Happy Planet Index. And it ends up being something that I've written about on a few occasions, saying, you know, the other day, I got lost in my car and I ended up going south in Bogota, you know, past the Centro, past the Candelaria to the other side. And there it was, I was taking photos from my car window very quickly of these, you know, DOS houses where they rent bunk beds for 5,000 pesos a night, and, you know, con televisor, it said, you know.
Yeah.
That. And the graffiti on the wall said, you know, there's no hope for any of us. I mean, this is a different world.
It is.
And you know, okay, you could be a backpacker or a tourist staying in one of the, you know, very nice hostels downtown and never, ever have any idea that exists. And that's where the displaced Embera, Catillo people live and everything, you know. So, I mean, it's fantastic that you are really, you know, investigating these subjects, which I find. Do you ever get negative messages from readers out there or Colombians?
I haven't had negative ones. To be honest, I was pretty worried. I almost didn't kind of set up my blog in this way, you know, having that other side of kind of the kind of poverty, social critique of the country, because I was worried about the backlash. Because I've noticed that just through expats I've met and people who have lived here a long time, people who have been here 6 months, regardless of their relationship with Colombia, there's just an overwhelming sense of, you know, that I'm trying to burst their bubble or something by talking about these issues, even in a lighthearted, you know, conversation. If I bring it up, it's like I'm offending their beautiful, like, paradise experience here. So I've been very kind of aware that I have to watch what I say, which is such a shame. But so I thought, you know what, I'm going to do my blog the way I want it. And if I get negative comments, I mean, I'm using evidence to back up my claims. I hope that it's a blog that's going to raise awareness. That's all I kind of aim to do. I'm not just criticizing for the sake of criticizing. For me, it's more than that. So far, no negative comments. You never know what people are thinking when they read it. So I would actually like to get more feedback from people, whether it's negative or positive. It's interesting to see people's takes on a certain issue, or for example, in a different city, it might be different. It's difficult to generalize. So yeah, if anybody feels like commenting, go ahead, positive or negative.
You're throwing down the gauntlet there. Well, listen, we're talking to Marie Quinney, who's half English, half French, based in Cali, the southern city of Colombia. I can hear the tropical birds chirping outside your window. It's filling me with envy as I'm up here in grey Bogota. The rains have started. It's become miserable again up here. But yes, anyone who wants to read Marie's blog, just look up Honestly Cali, put that into Google, and that will come up as Marie Quinney's blog. She's also on Twitter. I'll get her. What is your Twitter handle, Marie?
It's Honestly Cali.
Cali, it's easy enough. So put it in there and you'll find her, so you can get in touch, read her blog, because it's fascinating. She really has, made a very, very profound effort in getting, more information out there. This is not an idiot's guide to Colombia. It's a very academic, I would say, it's a conversation, but of academic levels, talking about her experiences. And remember that those are her experiences.
Yeah, of course.
So, if you do want to lay in and criticize, remember it is coming from her personal point of view, so of course, please be gentle with her.
Yes.
So we're going to take a short break, but before we go away, remember that you can get in touch with us at columbiacalling@gmail.com, our website Columbia Calling Radio, and of course on Twitter at Columbia Calling. Again, a big thank you out there to around the 6,000 of you who download this show every week. I am eternally flattered and continue to be so that we do have this niche market out there listening to my rantings and natterings about Colombia, and that we still continue to attract people to come on to be interviewed. So we're going to take a short break, and we'll be back with Marie Quinney and talking further about Cali and Colombia. Don't go away. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. We're here in Bogota, Colombia. As I say every week, 2,600 meters close to the stars, although in these days you won't see any stars because we're shrouded in the grey mist that beleaguers this city and makes it look a bit like London. We're talking to Marie Quinney in Cali. Welcome back, Marie, and thank you for agreeing to speak to us, and thank you for talking to us about your study on fatalism and poverty in Cali. And your blog, of course, Honestly Cali, which of course suggests that you are being honest. Now, I wanted to, you did put in your about section, and I do like addressing this because I think it's important for those of us making a life out here that, Colombia is not all about, what is exactly, so 24/7 sun, salsa parties and attractive women. You put that down in your blog. And I'm the first to say that as well. I'm the first. I get a lot of emails from people out there going, oh, I'm thinking of moving to Colombia. I love it. I want to be in Medellin. I want to be this. I want to be that. How can we spread the word a little bit better that, you try and make a life out here, we live as Colombians and not as expats. I think that's a reality, isn't it?
Yeah, I think coming here for maybe 6 months, maybe even up to a year, you can get away with completely romanticizing everything and going out partying. But I think as soon as you try to, get a job or put some real roots down and you potentially get a boyfriend, girlfriend, wife, husband here, and you meet their family, you really get your own life. I think it's very difficult to, from my perspective, it's very difficult to still live like an expat. You have to go through all the things that Colombians go through on a daily basis. So for me, it's been difficult to contrast my experience with the experience of other expats I've met who, like I said earlier, they seem sort of oblivious to what's happening around them. They've created this bubble, and this very comfortable bubble, because potentially they're earning very comfortable salaries, and they live in the nice areas, and they go from their bubble of the nice area of home to their bubble of work, and there's not that much else going on. So yeah, I think just raising awareness, just keeping talking about it, if more people would write about it on blogs, because people use blogs so much before moving somewhere just for tips on where to live, what the food's like. But if this was mixed with also the realities of life here and potentially the difficulties that you face with the bureaucracy or the, you know, the inequality, or there's an endless list, and even the safety. I mean, that's it. That's a key to living here successfully, is managing the safety issues. So, I mean, I would love for more blogs to address these issues as well.
Yes, true. But I want to just quickly go on to that. You mentioned safety in your time in Cali, in all of the periods of time that you spent there. Have you had any issues yourself?
I've actually been really lucky that I haven't. I mean, when I was here 4 years ago, my journey from home to work was really not very safe at all. And I was having to come back late at night, you know, up to 10 o'clock at night on my own, you know, lone female kind of prime target. And no, I haven't had anything, but I've been very careful. You know, it's not just that I've been lucky. I've been very careful what I've been wearing, where I've been going, not having anything on display. But I did, in that time, I did see two robberies in front of me of Colombians. So, you know, it was 2 meters in front of me. It could have been me. So just to say that, you know, nothing's happened to me doesn't mean it's necessarily safe. It just means I'm very careful.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, but I mean, it's like, it's not, let's say, I mean, London, for example, is, for its size, an incredibly safe city, in truth, but you wouldn't be walking around clapped and in provocative clothing,
exactly.
You know, and things like that. So it's the same, as you say, you had to go through a nasty, well, let's say, more down-at-heel neighbourhoods back at 10 o'clock at night. You take the, you know, you are aware of what you're doing.
Yeah.
And so, fair enough. So, you know, a young lady, blonde lady from Leamington Spa is going to stand out. Now, so tell us a little bit about your work, because you came without a job, right? You came back to Cali without a job, and you went through all of that process of finding, you know, getting yourself in legitimate employment.
Yeah, I mean, it really wasn't easy. You read a lot of blogs and or stories online of people who move abroad and find work, and it seems so simple. So I kind of convinced myself, you know, that'll be me, I'll do it. But it wasn't simple at all. But it was worth it. I basically booked myself a one-way ticket, and I was lucky enough to obviously have my boyfriend here so I could stay at his house. So financially it was easier. So I booked a one-way ticket and arrived, and I had about 4 months of nothing, of, you know, emails and harassing people and, you know, really chasing things up. And obviously here, as you know, the kind of style here, everything's quite slow and everything's quite last minute. So last minute, I think it was the end of November, I got offered a job. And I mean, that was just amazing, because I'd kind of given up hope, you know, after 3.5 months of nothing, thinking I'm going to have to go back to Europe. It was incredible. I was so happy.
And tell us, where are you working then?
So I'm working at SEAT. It stands for the International Centre for Tropical Agriculture. So it's here on the outskirts of Cali. At the beginning of my master's, I'd kind of realised that this centre existed. And so I got very excited and started trying to establish contacts with them from England. But that doesn't really work, because I guess if you're in the country, you're more real to them and they get to interview you and you're a real face. So I realized that I wasn't going to be able to secure a job from England. So coming here, I managed to chance an interview with them, and I was just very, very lucky. So I've been working there for just over 2 months now. I'm a visiting researcher, and basically SEAT is a research center for hunger and climate change. So the idea is to help farmers in the tropics to solve food security issues, but in an environmentally friendly way. So for what I'd want to do long term in my career, this was just the ideal kind of first step. So it's been great. It's been really, really good so far.
I would say that you've skipped several steps and found a very, very appropriate job.
Yeah, I think so too. I feel very fortunate.
You know, 4 months searching is not fun. Were there any points where you completely said, well, that's it, I've got to go, you know, in tears, I'm going to have to go home?
Not quite in tears, but I think deep down I had resigned myself to the fact that it wasn't going to work. You know, I wasn't going to find a job at SEAT. And so I was looking at other organisations. No one was really getting back to me. It's, you know, all the main organisations are in Bogota, So I was considering maybe having to move there, you know, but financially it's difficult. Bogota is expensive and my boyfriend lives here. So it was a stressful situation, you know. So if anyone's planning on making a move like that, it's not easy. It's doable, but it's not easy.
Yes, definitely. Now, I did some work. I used to work for WWF, and the first time they sent me to Cali, to the headquarters there. I had to travel up and down. This was 1998. Mm-hmm. The Pacific coast in a canoe, checking out the mangrove swamps.
Wow.
And it was about that sort of food security as well. It was about not shoving it down people's throats, but making them understand that you can't cut down the mangrove swamps for firewood, you know, because that's not only the barrier to, you know, from between the ocean, the sea and your homes, but also to provide you with your food. So it was really, really interesting. And of course, the Cali was the first place I got to know in Colombia. Remains in all of its chaotic beauty one of my favorite places. But you work out in this wonderful, I guess it's kind of pastoral out there in the outskirts of Cali where your office is, you know, palm mm-hmm. trees and tropical birds.
It's really, really beautiful. The grounds of CI is completely in the countryside. Because there's a lot of scientists, you know, making new seed varieties. They need lots of land to plant them and things. So it's a really, really peaceful environment. It's like a little oasis, which is obviously, especially for Colombia, it's a very, very unusual working environment, very unusual place to have an office. You look out your window and just see like fields and trees and birds, and it's gorgeous. It really is.
It just sounds like paradise. As I overlook the Carrera Septima here in and the perpetual crashes in front of my apartment. That sounds very nice indeed. And now, in all of your time in Cali, then, with all of your interviews and the time that you spent there, have you like made sorties into sort of other of the, you know, the barrios of the, let's say, the more down at heel, the more humble, to do studies like such as Siloé or as Aguas Blancas or anything like that? Have you been, you know, these are the particularly recognized areas for poverty.
Have I been to them?
Yes.
No. And I'm not sure I would, if I'm honest. Most of my participants were from Siloé and Agua Blanca. So I've obviously spoken to people from there, but I'm not sure I would go. I mean, as my boyfriend's parents say, they've only ever seen them on TV. You know, they are very dangerous, and me being female A and, you know, foreigner B, I don't think I would go. I mean, I would love to just to explore it, and, you know, but safety wise, I think it would be a bit of a risk.
Yeah, it's without the contacts and everything. I have a friend who's an American photographer who has been doing all sorts of studies up there in Siloé. And he just walks up there now. He's known by everyone. He just wanders in to watch football games and wanders into people's houses and stuff. And then the last time, years ago, that I was in Cali, properly in Cali, I was down there with Children of the Andes, and they took me into Aguas Blancas. But it was at a certain time of day that we could go in, that we could...
But
they were saying, this is a division line between two gangs, this is this, that, you know, the bullet holes in the walls. I mean, it really was, again, another world.
Which
brings me quite nicely onto my next point, because you write about on your blog the segregation of classes.
Yes.
Which is immense here. And we come from the UK and France for that matter as well. Class system is very marked. I mean, you know where people are from, you know how just their accents, you know where they've been to school, etc., etc. But here in Colombia, I mean, you talked about it earlier in the strata system. It's almost, you know, from day one, this is where you belong and this is where you'll stay, you know.
And I've
come to this belief that while previously there used to be no, let's say, economic mobility and no social mobility, now you can see economic mobility, but it does not go hand in hand with social mobility here in Colombia. Do you have any thoughts on the issues?
I mean, for me, the strata system kind of encapsulates everything, or a lot of the issues here in terms of race and poverty, inequality, and it's really bizarre for me as an outsider that it's kind of an officially recognized government implemented hierarchy, and it just affects so much of people's identities. And like you said, the lack of social mobility, that everybody knows everybody's number, and you know your address. If you go for a job interview, for example, and you have to put your address or even I don't know, the school you went to, they'll kind of have an idea of what strata you are. Or, for example, your skin colour, they may have an idea of what strata you are. And I think it just prevents a lot of social mobility, a lot of opportunities are lost because of this strata system that kind of divides everybody up. And for me, I mean, after 4 years of knowing Colombia and living here and everything, I still can't get my head around it. And it's very sad for me, I think.
Yeah, I find it difficult at times. You know, you go into a shop, let's say, you know, some sort of upmarket furniture shop or whatever, and I'm just looking because it's not easy to find something that, you know, I've got this little hotel and stuff and I'm trying to furnish it and everything. And you walk in and you're talking to the, let's say, the attendant there, and then someone from strato 6 up, you know, anywhere between 6 and 21, let's say, walks in and just immediately barks over you. Immediately, you know, who's supposed to be attending here? Who's doing this? Right. And you're like, you know, nothing can change if this continues. I mean, I know that's the most basic and perhaps, you know, I know that's very, it's a very loose and not a very strong example, but it does, it's very visible. Everything is very visual in this, you know, the people getting in and out of their armored cars, you know, and of course, economic mobility doesn't really mean that anything's changing because you've got the fast money sort of, you know, background of people getting involved in the wrong, like, let's say, illicit industries in Colombia, just getting money fast. And then you see them, let's say you go to Cartagena and you want to go to one of the, let's say, one of the chic restaurants, you'll see the bodyguards or the guards outside not allowing the people from the fast money in, because they might have these, like, you know, let's say, sort of like, say, you know, the appearance of a vallenato singer, more like, or, you know, it's like they're going to put the people who are of surname and inherited and historical money ill at ease. So these people won't be allowed in. So I find myself always grappling with this, and of course it comes back to your point about the fatalism and poverty. I don't think it, you know, it's not unique to Cali at all, but it's all through Latin America really, and yet I find myself trying to grapple with it. I write, and I'm trying to write my own little book and everything, and how much can I say without offending a lot of people? I think that's what I always come back to.
Yeah.
It's tough, you know, especially in my little town with the white Creole upper class, you know.
Exactly.
And they're very visible, but again, at nighttime, because they don't want to go out in daytime because they don't want to get tanned, you know.
There's so many issues intertwined with this strata system, this hierarchy. Especially about race, it's such an interesting case in Colombia, where the high stratas, the elites, are the whites who are the minority. For example, in South Africa, the whites were the minority, and the blacks were the majority. But here, since the whites are the minority, but then what's the biggest other majority? Because you've got a lot of mixing, you've got a lot of blacks, but there's not a big majority against the whites, or not against, that's a poor use of the word, but you know what I mean, like apart from the whites. And what I found really interesting as well is that a lot of mixed people, so mixed with, I don't know, white and indigenous, for example, which is the most common ethnicity, they often self-identify as white, which is, I think, a symptom of just the general kind of racial hierarchies here, that if you have a little bit of white in you, you kind of identify as white, which means that the statistics on racism are almost non-existent, because the indigenous group are self-identifying as white and are not perceived as being discriminated against for that reason. So all the statistics about racism are about the black people, but not about the indigenous. So I find that really interesting, because it kind of dilutes the problem a bit, and it allows you to kind of think that there isn't a racism, or there is only racism towards the you know, Afro-Colombian society. And related to the strata system, everybody wants to kind of jump up. They want to marry up. They want to, you know, marry somebody with a better skin color or with a better strata. And that might be oversimplifying things, but I have heard people say, you know, oh, she married so-and-so, she improved her blood. Things like that. There's a lot of language which kind of exemplifies a lot of the culture of strata, of hierarchy, of race. That's all very intertwined.
Well, that's it. I mean, I get the mention in my wife's family that she's Blanquiando de la family, you know?
Yeah.
You know, because I'm the white Anglo-Saxon, although we wouldn't know it to look at me, but I have Pied Noir roots. You wouldn't know it at all. but that's it, you know, and I'm fascinated by that history, but no one really wants to talk about it. But so it's interesting. Now, tell us a little bit about this. Tell us about, you know, your boyfriend. You've been together since 2011.
Yeah.
He's doing something incredibly special, isn't he? Tell us about his project.
Well, he's just finishing a degree at the University of Derby in the UK. It's a distance learning degree. So he finishes in July, and then he's looking to pursue a master's to do with addictions and neuroscience. And he applied to several universities in the UK, and he got an offer from Cambridge, which was incredible. And so he's looking to kind of fund that so that he can take up the offer. And he's able to defer it for a year because obviously time's running out for this year to start in September. But so I've started fundraising for him in the hope that, you know, one day he'll be able to have enough money to do it, because it's incredibly expensive for, even for British students, it's very expensive to do a master's, but even more so for foreigners. And a lot of the scholarships out there are, you know, just for academic excellence. They don't take into account financial needs and things like that. I've started a GoFundMe page for him, without him knowing. He wasn't too pleased. He was a little bit embarrassed that I was kind of advertising this on his behalf, but he's obviously very grateful as well. So I did that behind his back, and I think we've raised just over £100 so far. People have been very generous. I've put a link to it on my blog. I think there's a permanent banner on the right side. So if anybody's interested in, you know, addictions, neuroscience, his aim is to prevent addictions long term. And obviously it's something close to his heart, being from Colombia, and, you know, the drugs trade and just addictions within the country have crippled a lot of the country, and the economy is dependent on the drug trade. So I think it's something he's very passionate about it. And he's obviously very able, getting an offer from Cambridge. So if anybody would like to help, we'd both be eternally grateful.
So this is a shout out. This is a shout out from here, from Bogota and from Cali. For anyone out there listening to this, you know, what's his name? Sorry, your boyfriend?
Juan Felipe
has got a place at Cambridge to study this. You know, there are issues of addiction, neuroscience, and so on, a master's in this. You know, this is possibly not just life-changing for Juan Felipe, but life-changing for many other people out there, and of course the Colombian situation.
Absolutely.
Perhaps there could be some sort of geographical scholarship rather than academic excellence, you know, places that need these more. So anyway, get on that website, the Honestly Cali website. You can see the banner. It's there on the right-hand side. There's a picture of Juan Felipe there. Fund him, please. I know there's 6,000 of you out there. You know, if it's just $10, it's just $10, but it's going to the right cause. Please.
Absolutely.
Get involved. It's really important. These things are important. So thank you for telling us about that. That's really good. Now, you've been traveling recently. You went off to San Andres and you're up there on the Caribbean island close to Nicaragua. So how did you find it?
It was great. It was really, really beautiful. I mean, what they say about, I think they call it the sea of the seven colors or something like that in Spanish, and they're not lying. I think we counted 8 colors on one day. It's really beautiful. Unfortunately, it was very windy, very, very windy, which meant that a lot of the boat trips were cancelled. But we found that renting a golf buggy to go around the island, and, you know, you go away from all the hotels and resorts and things, and you go to the actual towns where people live, and you see the real life of the people on San Andres, and you can go snorkeling, and it is really great. It was really, really beautiful, and a really interesting mix of cultures, because obviously it's very Colombian, they speak Spanish, but then equally it's very Caribbean, and they have a history with English. They were invaded, I think, by English pirates or something. So a lot of the natives are bilingual, English and Spanish, which was brilliant. I loved it. I loved just sitting listening to them switching from English to Spanish natively. It was fascinating.
Yeah, it's the sort of pidgin English. And of course, they've all got surnames that date back to the pirates, like Archibald and Campbell and everything. It was all, it's Henry Morgan's history. The guy who sacked Panama. And of course, did you get up to Providencia, which is paradise?
No, we didn't. Gosh. No.
That for me is it's unrivaled.
Yeah, I think that'll have to be for next time. We definitely want to go back, because obviously the wind slightly ruined some of it for us. So we were like, right, it's a good excuse to go back, and then we'd have to go to Peruvian NCO as well.
Even that would have made the sea crossing, had you done it, unbearable. I mean, you would have probably arrived in 5 kilos lighter, having vomited there. And the flight that's only 15 minutes would have been just terrifying, I think, in that kind of wind.
Probably.
You know, tiny propeller aircraft. That
bobbles. Oh, God.
I don't even think the word bobble doesn't even describe it. You know, so, anyway, so you've been traveling around a bit, you're based in that area, the southwest. When are you coming up to Mompos to visit us up here near the Caribbean coast?
We've definitely got plans to go back to the Caribbean, because we went 4 years ago, but obviously we did a quick trip. There's so much more to see. Sometime this year, we're definitely going to organise a trip up there, and you've definitely put Mompos on the map.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah.
That's the idea. And have your family come out to visit you here in Colombia?
They haven't. Before I left, they were talking about it. My mum was saying, if you're going to be out there for, you know, more than a year, I'll just definitely have to come, because I wouldn't plan on going back home. You know, if I was here for 2 years, I wouldn't go back. You know, it's a lot of money just to go back for a couple of weeks. And there's so much traveling to do here. I'd really like them to come. They've never been, well, my parents have never been to Latin America, so it would be quite a good introduction, and they'd have their personal guide in me and my boyfriend. So I'm definitely gonna have to work on them, I think.
Yeah, I think it's time now. I think it's time. Yeah. You've invested a certain amount of lifestyle here and everything. I think it's time that you brought your kids out.
Yeah, definitely.
And you can ease them in, you know, Cali, Cartagena, places that are you know, civilized, let's say.
Yeah, the tourist.
And the coffee zone. Everybody loves a coffee zone. It's only
a
hour from you.
Yeah,
well, listen, we've been talking to Marie Quinney. Her blog is Honestly Cali, and her Twitter handle as well, Honestly Cali. Marie, thank you so much for your time. It's been really fun.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, okay. So, and of course, you've opened our eyes to this different, this whole different aspect, you know, sort of poverty and fatalism. You know, people don't think about that, and I think it's something that's just so omnipresent here. Hopefully, this has been a thought provoking show for some of you out there, and that you've now got another blog to read. Please, and also, you know, again, another call out to fund Juan Felipe's potential study in Cambridge. I'm not even going to say potential anymore. I'm going to say study, because he is going to go. We're going to get him there. We're going to get him to.
Thank you so much for your help.
All right. Well, so I hope everyone out there has enjoyed the show with Marie Quinney. As I say, always get in touch with us at columbiacallingradio.com or columbiacalling@gmail.com and at columbiacalling on Twitter. And then I take this time and this moment again to say thank you very much to Marie Quinney down there in Cali. Best of luck to Juan Felipe, her boyfriend, in this next stage in his career. It just sounds like everything is going so well down there.
It is.
So we're going to sign off now. Again, one last thank you. And this has been Columbia Calling. I've been Richard McCall. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Thank you again.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, it doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first 3 audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.